France bans the burqa. Ontario discovers Sharia law. Woody Allen dismisses faith. The Pope goes to Britain. And John F. Kennedy gives a speech. This is September 16, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The government of France has banned the public wearing of the burqa, the traditional Islamic garb worn by approximately 2,000 women in France. Incredible controversy. France prides itself on religious liberty, but as we will note, there is no First Amendment in any French constitution. Therefore, issues like the wearing of the burqa become issues of ongoing controversy in that nation. France has debated many of the issues related to the public identification of religious faith, wearing religious symbols, wearing religious garb in public. The French public schools for many years have become centers of this controversy, where children are forbidden from wearing jewelry or clothing that would indicate their own religious faith. Obviously, when it comes to a nation like France that has had such a difficult and complex religious background, overwhelmingly Catholic at one point, absolutely secularist in terms of revolutionary fervor, including a good many Protestants, and now a radical infusion of Islamic immigrants, what you have in France is a recipe for a great deal of discontent. Now, the burqa was banned in France because France has an official government policy of secularization. The idea of laicization or secularization is so important to France that it sees the wearing of the burqa by only an approximate 2,000 Islamic women in France as absolutely intolerable. Now, I'll have to tell you that I find this to be an issue that will be hard to determine. It would be very difficult to adjudicate this issue, not so much on religious grounds, but on issues of social cohesion, and not to mention national security. It is difficult to imagine how in many contexts a person who is shrouded virtually from head to toe can gain entry into public space and negotiate public movement. But the issue in France was not so much about security. It wasn't so much about individual identity as it was about the fact that the burqa becomes in itself a great stumbling block to the idea of secularization. Now, when you look at this issue in France and at this contemporary debate, be aware, of course, that Europe as a whole is embroiled in similar controversies. In recent years and months, there have been controversies in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, and beyond. Yes, even in Switzerland, that nation that has prided itself on such placidity and peace, the Swiss voted by a 58% majority to ban the building of any further minarets. The infusion of so many Islamic immigrants into Western Europe, and indeed the rising political power and the perceived threat of Islam within Europe, has become a major focus of concern, and for good reason. The birth rates of these Islamic immigrants are vastly greater than those of the natural-born French or Germans, or increasingly even Eastern Europeans such as Czechs and Poles. We're looking at a changing composition of Europe. There are keen observers who believe that Europe has an Islamic future. Thus, historians of the future may look back at this vote in France as something of a last gasp of secularization. I think as an American looking at this, we scratch our heads and wonder how in the world the French negotiate this issue by issue in such an awkward way. But as Christians, I think we need to look at this and be reminded that a secular state is not an empty state. Something comes in to fill that space. The human heart and the public square both abhor a vacuum. And in this case, what is entering the French public space, and in so many issues now, the French personal space, is Islam. And of course, it's not just about what's going on in Europe, although that is ground zero of sorts in terms of this Islamic influence. Canadians have awakened in recent days to the fact that even in their province of Ontario, there are some Sharia law courts operating with at least tacit government support. This is a huge story because, of course, Canada is one of those places you might think would be rather unlikely, given its liberalism, to find operating Sharia courts, especially in a province like Ontario, and especially with some kind of tacit governmental approval. But what you find in many centers of Islamic concentration, where the population of Muslims is dense, what you find is the demand that Muslims be able to operate and adjudicate on their own matters, especially related to family law, of divorce, of certain property settlements. And the demand is, on the basis of religious liberty, that they have the freedom to have these issues adjudicated in Islamic courts under Sharia law. Now, the people of Ontario had been assured in times past that these courts would not operate, but recent reports indicate that they are. Now, let's just think about that for a moment. If that's true in Ontario, the reality is it could be true in many other places as well. Indeed, where there are centers of great Islamic population, just consider the debate in London in recent years, as the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Reverend Rowan Williams, actually suggested that there might be some validity to allowing in Britain the operation of some Sharia courts for Islamic citizens. How long will it be before we hear similar arguments made here? Woody Allen is well known as a maker of films. And of course, as a maker of films, he is known for his existentialism and for his unique approach, his wry humor, his rather agnostic Jewish worldview that permeates his films and his art. Well, Woody Allen has a new film out. The film is entitled You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. Sony Pictures Classics is to release this film next Wednesday. But in anticipation of that release, Woody Allen gave an interview to the New York Times. In that interview, he spoke of his own secularism, indeed his agnosticism or atheism, in very straightforward terms. It seems that this new movie, You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, has to do with a woman who gains insight from a prophetess, a fortune teller. When asked why he would use such a device, Woody Allen said this, "To me, there's no real difference between a fortune teller or a fortune cookie and any of the organized religions. They're all equally valid or invalid, really, and equally helpful." And of course, by that he means unhelpful. When he was asked about faith, he said this, "I was interested in the concept of faith in something. This sounds so bleak when I say it, but we need some delusions to keep us going. And the people who successfully delude themselves seem happier than the people who can't. I've known people who put their faith in religion and in fortune tellers, so it occurred to me that this was a good character for a movie. A woman who had everything fail, and all of a sudden, it turned out that a woman telling her fortune was helping her. The problem is, of course, she's in for a rude awakening." End quote. The questioner then said, "What seems more plausible to you, that we've existed in past lives, or that there is a God?" Woody Allen answered, "Neither seems plausible to me. I have a grim scientific assessment of it. You just feel, I just feel, what you see is what you get." End quote. That tells us a great deal about Woody Allen's worldview. Nothing really new there, but in its starkness, in its indeed agnosticism or atheism, it really demonstrates what is behind so much of contemporary art. And in particular, let's go back to the fact that Woody Allen has been described for many, many years and decades as basically a Jewish existentialist. That existentialism is a philosophy that suggests that life is inherently meaningless. Now, one of the sad things about Woody Allen's art is that given his artistic ability and given his sense of humor, he is able to make meaninglessness look funny. You know, it tells us a great deal about fallen humanity, that a sense of meaninglessness actually becomes something like a laugh track. When in the hands of a skillful director or producer, a storyteller or an artist, meaninglessness can become something that we consider almost attractive, perhaps even preferable to the demands of meaning. Well, consider that when you consider Woody Allen's latest film, or for that matter, his entire cinematographic project. But of course, this story is not only about Woody Allen, but about so many others as well. On the other hand, when we cross the Atlantic, the big story is Pope Benedict XVI making the very first state visit of a pope to the nation of Britain. That's right. There never has been, in the history of the British Isles, an official state visit by a pope. That's big news, and it's big news for a lot of reasons. Popes have visited England in the past, but never on a state visit. Pope John Paul II was there almost 30 years ago, but it was a church visit. The visit of Pope Benedict this time to the United Kingdom is inherently controversial for a host of reasons. Just consider the scandal over child sexual abuse in England. Just consider the volatility of that debate in especially Ireland and in some English dioceses. Consider the secularism that now marks so much of England. Consider controversies over the fact that women cannot serve as priests, and thus Benedict is considered horribly out of step, and the Roman Catholic Church with him in much of England. Consider the fact, and this is really sensitive, that Pope Benedict XVI will be making the first state visit by a pope to England. That's right, England, the nation which in the 16th century saw Henry VIII as king announce his independence from the pope and from the Church of Rome and establish the Church of England with himself, by no coincidence, as its head. In recent years, Pope Benedict XVI, formerly Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, has extended an olive branch to the Anglican Communion by not only suggesting that, well, perhaps they might have better relations between the churches, but in doing what has been considered inherently hostile by the Anglican Communion, he has offered a means for Anglican priests to come into the Roman Catholic Church. Well, that means that Pope Benedict is stepping into a great deal of controversy. In times past, we have noted that in anticipation of this visit, prominent secularists and atheists such as Richard Dawkins and now Stephen Hawking and Stephen Fry as authors and many others are calling for the Pope either to be shunned or for there to be protests, or in the case of Richard Dawkins, there is the call for the Pope to be arrested as a violator of human rights. And no one really expects that to happen. But what's really interesting is that a great deal of what's going on here has to do with the fact that this is the Pope. This is the Bishop of Rome, who is arriving in England not so much as a bishop, not so much as a churchman, but as a head of state. This is a state visit. You know, as an evangelical Protestant, I have to say that the problem of the papacy is the entirety of the papacy. But if there is any one issue that shows why the papacy is such a problem, it is that in this case, Benedict is arriving claiming to be a head of state. That state, of course, being the Vatican. And that is a huge problem. But as I've said, that's just one among many problems of the papacy. The papacy itself is the problem. It was 50 years ago this week that presidential candidate John F. Kennedy gave a speech in Houston that has become one of the most famous political speeches of all American history. It was on September 12, 1960, that candidate John F. Kennedy, then Senator John F. Kennedy, went into the teeth of criticism as he was a Roman Catholic candidate running for president, and as we know, he became the first Roman Catholic elected president of the United States. On September 12, 1960, candidate Kennedy went to Houston and spoke to the Greater Houston Ministers Association. Now, in the background to this was fierce controversy over his candidacy. Claims that the newly elected, if elected, Roman Catholic president would be controlled not so much by his own political convictions, but by the Pope, or by the Magisterium of the Roman Catholic Church, or by the Cardinal Archbishops of the Church in the United States, or by Catholic doctrine. Now, in the face of that criticism, Senator Kennedy went to Houston and spoke to an overwhelmingly Protestant audience and gave them, oddly enough, what they appeared to be looking for. He gave them assurances that his own Catholic faith would have virtually nothing to do with the way he would govern and lead and preside as President of the United States. He said that voters should be concerned not so much about what church he believed in, but what kind and vision of America he believed in. He used language that we now recognize because we've heard it so many times since. We've heard so many candidates, whether Roman Catholic or otherwise, go to a microphone and try to assure the American people that their beliefs will not shape or influence their political decision-making. Now, I am among those who believe that the argument that John F. Kennedy made in that speech is absolutely disastrous. I do not believe, and a good number of others, I certainly hope, do not believe, that any individual who holds sincere beliefs about the most ultimate questions of life can then turn straightforwardly and say that those beliefs will not inform how we will lead, how we will decide, how we will reason and adjudicate in any context, much less a context of such supreme and extraordinary power and influence as the highest elected office in the land. You know, it appeared that back in 1960, those Protestant ministers wanted John F. Kennedy to say what he said. I happen to be Roman Catholic, but it really doesn't matter. I think now Americans 50 years later had better recognize that that's a recipe for intellectual and political disaster. It's also a recipe for a complete falsity of the argument about the importance of our own convictions. Now, Americans over the past 50 years have been confronted with all kinds of situations that, quite frankly, are far more complicated than a Roman Catholic running for the highest elected office in the land. But one thing I hope we have learned is this: worldviews matter, convictions matter. And the argument that I find least plausible, and beyond that, certainly least attractive, is the argument that convictions do not matter. Of course they do. They must matter. The issue is, what convictions does a man or a woman hold, and how will those convictions shape their decision-making in public life? Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You will find this program, my weekly program, Thinking in Public, and a host of other resources at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. Boyce College Preview Day will be held on October 22. This is an excellent opportunity for you to learn more of Boyce College and its outstanding programs. For more information, visit boycecollege.com. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.